Chapter 12. Ardamantua. The sky was weeping light. Slaughter kicked his way through a half-collapsed section of tunnel walls and hauled himself onto the softly curving upper surface of the blister nest. It was raining some kind of liquid that wasn't water through an ugly squall that blew sidelong and made every surface slick and sticky. The nest was a huge sprawl like some mass of offal oozing on a slab, magnified to titanic proportions. There were loops of tunnel that looked like intestinal knots. There were renal lumps and lobed chambers. Some sections of the vast organic city were patterned coils like the fossil imprint of ancient seashells. Other sections were crushed to pulp by orbital bombardment and airstrikes. Smoke bled up from the blister nest in a thousand places, mixed with the wind and washed into the squalling storm. Slaughter heard the downpour tick and tap on his helm and armor.
"Come up," he called.
Cutthroat climbed after him and then reached down to haul the disheveled Magus biologist up out of the tunnel. After them came Stab and Woundmaker. Slaughter had left the rest of Daylight Wall inside the nest under Frenzy's command. The Chapter Master's express orders had been to get Laurentis to the contact point. Well, four of them could do that. There was no sense pulling a whole company out. He'd voxed that decision to the Lanxium, but he hadn't had a reply. Something was chopping Vox and Pick to hell. Atmospherics. It was like Caradon Monument all over again. They'd been deaf and blind there, and they'd still won. The Magus biologist was looking around, blinking at the daylight. The rain ran off his face and plastered his robes to his body.
What's that?
He asked, pointing at the sky.
We haven't got time for sightseeing, snapped Woundmaker.
Woundmaker was a sergeant, a good man. In the last stretch of tunnel, they'd come upon one of the automated munition trains sent in to support them. It had been mangled beyond recognition by chrome warrior forms and the servitors slain. But Woundmaker and Stab had managed to drive the enemy off and recover some reloads for their bolters. He was sorting and distributing them.
No, look, said Laurentis.
Slaughter took the four clips Woundmaker handed him and turned to look where the Magus biologist was pointing. There was a light in the sky. It was a broad, diffuse light, weeping out of the ugly cloud cover, but there was a malicious little glowing coal at the heart of it, small and red, like the ember fragment of a star.
That's a ship death, said Cutthroat bluntly.
Slaughter heard Woundmaker curse. He'd been too ready to dismiss the Magus biologist's comment, but he could see that Cutthroat was right. They could all see he was right. They'd all seen a ship die from planet side. It was a heartbreaking thing.
When in Throne's name did these vermin get orbital weapons? Asked Woundmaker. When did they get ship-to-ship capability?
We still don't know precisely how the chromes distribute themselves across space, said Laurentis. It is presumed they employ some form of pod or seed dispersal via fluctuations in the warp, but a full-scale migration of the magnitude that would explain their population density here has never been witnessed or described. We don't believe they have what we would consider to be ships or a fleet, no vessels at all, but... He fell silent. Four angular visors glared at him, rain beading off their beaked jaws.
I'm just saying, Laurentis managed,
I don't know how the chromes could have taken out one of our ships. Perhaps it is an unhappy coincidence or an accident.
There are no coincidences, Stab told him.
Cutthroat began to say something about accidents and defaming the ability of the fleet.
Well, something's happened, said Slaughter, cutting them both off. That's a dead ship up there, and a big one too. The Magus is right. If the chromes couldn't hit it, that leaves accident or coincidence. And coincidence means...
What?
Asked Laurentis.
Someone else, said Slaughter.
A noise burst filled the air. Outdoors in the stinking open air, it was like the booming of a war horn, the braying of some demonic voice. The air seemed to shudder. All four Imperial fists winced as it stripped through their helmet vox systems and assaulted their ears. Laurentis felt it prickle his skin. The hairs on his arm rose despite the rain. static. Ozone. Around the distant broken steeples at the blister nest heart, chain lightning flickered and crackled in a sickly yellow display. Two more noise bursts followed. Laurentis felt the actual structure of the blister nest beneath them resonate with a plangent sound.
The Chromes are capable of a great deal more than we realize, Laurentis told his guardians. These noises, these bursts of noise, they are why your chapter master has charged you to protect me. I have a theory.
Tell us, said Slaughter bluntly.
Laurentis nodded and shrugged.
I will, sir. I think it's communication. I think the Chromes are trying to communicate with us. We understood them to be non-sapient animals, but we may have been very wrong about that. I wish to test the communication theory, and that is why I need to get to the drop point to access specialist equipment.
Slaughter nodded. He checked the Auspex mounted across his left forearm.
Tracking the drop. It'll be down at DZ-457 in the next 20 minutes. Let's move.
They started off, crossing the oddly ridged humps and rain-slick gullies of the blister nest's upper surface. The fists, with their strength, long stride and armoured feet, had no trouble negotiating the unpleasant material. Laurentis kept slipping and slithering. He was wet and cold to the bone. Woundmaker kept picking him up by the scruff of his robes and setting him back on his feet, as if he were some clumsy toddler.
The point of the communication, said Laurentis, out of breath and struggling to keep up. I mean, the point I was making was that if the Chromes are capable of communication, if they are capable of language, then they may be capable of much else besides. They can clearly cross between worlds and star systems in ways we cannot divine. Maybe they can take out ships. Maybe they have potent weapons for void fights.
Ships of their own, after all, said Slaughter.
Perhaps.
If they are capable of communication, said Slaughter, pausing for a moment to look at the Magus biologist. If you prove your theory...
Yes.
What are you trying to say?
Laurentis paused.
I first presumed, Captain, that they might be trying to negotiate surrender. That was when they seemed to be at our mercy, when their nest seemed to be toppling under assault.
And now?
Now, I wonder if it might not be a warning, a cry of defiance, a challenge. Now, I wonder if they might not be demanding our surrender.
Because they're hurting us?
Laurentis sighed.
They are, it seems, taking out our starships. They are harrying our ground assault. The successful outcome of this undertaking is not as clear-cut as we first imagined.
They followed the rim of the nest down, along to the ugly, chordate ridges that pressed like giant finger bones into the mud of the river's edge. The noise bursts continued to bark across the smoke-wrapped distances, causing the rain to squall and billow. Laurentis tried to keep a basic log of observable details on his data slate as he struggled to keep up with his transhuman bodyguards. Fountains of ash and light vomited into the air from regions on the far side of the central blister nest, and the concussive booms reached them a moment later.
Major munitions, said Slaughter.
Orbital strike? Asked Cutthroat.
Woundmaker shook his head.
Looked like subterranean. So, our enemy has further weapons we don't know about?
Asked Stab.
That they destroy their own nest with? Asked Cutthroat. Don't argue. Don't debate. Slaughter snapped. Get moving!
Another blast rocked the ground, and a huge plume sheeted into the dismal sky 6 or 7 kilometers away. The fists of Daylight Wall stoically and obediently ignored it and started moving onwards. Laurentis hurried with them.
It could be a new weapon, conjectured the Magus biologist, a little out of breath. They might, I suppose... They might destroy their own nest if there was nothing left to be gained from protecting it. It might be intended to create confusion and disarray, to take as many of us with them as possible.
For what purpose?
Asked Slaughter, getting his hand under Laurentis's armpit and frog-marching him over to a stretch of mud so slick it was like quicksand.
If they had a final asset to protect, Laurentis ventured, A queen, or the equivalent? A dominant reproductive female? The egg source? I'm just hypothesizing, but if the nest was lost, they might destroy it as cover for an evacuation of the queen.
There was another blast. This one came from much closer at hand. The force of it knocked all five of them over and slapped out a wall of mud and steam. Debris pattered down, and the rain ran brown. The imperial fists struggled to their feet. Laurentius coughed and shivered, trying to clear his head.
"My gravitics are shot," reported Stab, checking his visor display. "Mine too," said Cutthroat. "No, correction. Gravitic register is working. It's just showing very irregular patterning." "Agreed," said Stab. "Rechecking. Local gravity just looped for 10 milliseconds, and that blast focus was gravitically strong." "These weapons. These new weapons," Slaughter asked. "They're what? Gravity weapons? Gravity bombs?"
Laurentius struggled to reply. He tried to formulate a reasonable-sounding explanation for why the Chromes should have mastery over gravity, one of the universe's most notoriously uncooperative forces. Maybe their intersystem travel relied on some gravitic drive.
"Watch your heels!" Cutthroat yelled.
Chromes were rushing them from the nest pods behind them. They were standard forms, their silvery shells glinting in the stained light, spattered with mud and liquid, but there were a lot of them. Cutthroat and Stab met the first of them side by side, driving strokes and slices with their hefty blade weapons that sent the Xenos tumbling and bouncing backwards, slamming into the ranks behind, slit and spraying. The stink of ichor filled the rain. Slaughter and Woundmaker got Laurentius back and began to struggle down the reed-choked slope towards the waterline. The ground, wet as a marsh, was littered with dead Xenos from the first phase. Moving backwards, Stab and Cutthroat came after them. Laurentius, gasping with anxiety, marveled at their blade work. The speed of it, the relentless fury, the precision. Severed pieces of chromes flew up into the air, spinning. Ichor jetted. The pushing ranks of assaulting Xenos stumbled and clambered over the bodies of their dead. Laurentius had seen ants do that. Forest ants at the edge of a stream, the first ones drowning and dying so that those behind could use their corpses as a bridge, as a growing bridge. The ants always got across the stream. Ants never mourned their dead. They used them. Another wave of chromes scurried towards them along the bank to their right, clacking and sounding out the tek-tek-tek noise they made with their mouthparts. Slaughter, positioned on the right, turned to meet them, his broadsword coming out. None of the Space Marines had resorted to bolters, conservation of munition supplies. Slaughter's blade met the first chrome, half impaled it, then hurled it bodily across the river. It arced and hit the water with a dirty splash. His sword swung back and decapitated the next, and then cleaved the third down the middle through the head.
"Protect the principal!"
Slaughter roared. Laurentius cowered on the mudflats. The four fists closed in around him at compass points, each one meeting the assault as it swirled around them from the two lines of attack. There was so much ichor spray in the air that the rain tasted of it. They were all dappled with it. The Chromes threw themselves against the four-point defense, finding only death and dismemberment as a reward for their efforts. There is nothing, Laurentius remembered the old saying, as deadly as an imperial fist standing his ground. Laurentius wondered how much scrutiny the masters of the chapters and other senior minds of the imperial military, and even the beloved and exalted emperor himself, when he had set to devising the Legiones Astartes, formulating their minds and bodies, how much scrutiny had they given to natural history, to the behavior of cooperative animals and insects, to their selfless and almost mechanical efforts? The individual was never important, only the group effect. One quick glance at a Magus biologist's notebook or cyclopedia would reveal 1,000 examples in nature of selfless cooperation, post-logical stratagems, and ensured survival. A huge armored beetle could easily kill a tiny lone ant, but the ants always got across the stream.